It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Congress is working on different kinds of gun legislation. We'll talk to a firearms law expert about the bills that might pass and the impact they could have. First, the pandemic disrupted the way kids learn in school, and that led some educators to find creative ways to keep young people engaged. That includes our next guest. When classes in Milwaukee public schools went virtual, she started a YouTube channel reading children's books out loud. Now, 2 years later, it's gotten thousands of views, and it's gone on the road, including some very special locations.
Good afternoon. It is a terrific Tuesday, and we are here for our Tuesday Read Aloud, and I am on the 50-yard line of Lambeau Field. It just doesn't get any better than that.
She's with us to share that project and some of her top summer reading picks for kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have favorite memories of reading to a kid or being read to as a kid or a grown-up? Have you found a way to help spark kids' interest in reading? Maybe something special during the pandemic as a parent or maybe a teacher or school staffer yourself. And do you have a favorite children's book, past or present? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Danette Justice is a literacy coach with Milwaukee Public Schools, the creator of the Just Us and Books reading show on YouTube. Her work was highlighted in the Wisconsin Weavers series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Danette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us how the idea for Just Us and Books came to be?
Well, in the beginning of 2020, the first day of school, I usually go around and read a book to the students to welcome them back. I couldn't do that, so I made a recording of myself reading for the students, and I thought that would be it. I posted it to the teachers' Google Classrooms, and one of the students put a little message under there and said, "Wow, Ms. Justice, you're a good reader." And I was like, "Oh, well, thank you." And so one of the teachers said, "That was good. What are you reading next week?" And I was like, "Oh, next week. I guess I'll need to figure out something." And next week became another week and another week, and it became something weekly.
And I understand over time your production values went up some with a little help from a friend.
Yes, yes. My nephew, his name is Maceo Bracey. He is a student at Golda Meir School here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, MPS. And he had been going out with me to various locations and helping me to record the videos. And then one day he said, "You know, I'm going to take the video and I'm going to do some stuff to it." And I was like, "Okay, well, go right ahead." And he did his first video, and that one was the Bucks reading that I did at the Pfizer Forum. And he added graphics, he added visuals, he put the book in the story, and he just really made the reading come alive. So it's actually one of my favorite. It's called The Me I Choose to Be.
And you, I played the clip of you reading at Lambeau. You just mentioned Fiserv Forum. What led you to take your readings out on the road and on location?
You know, it actually started one day. I was at home. It was a snow day. And it was, I've been trying to stay consistent with the readings, and it was a snow day. And I was like, "Well, let me just go in the backyard during this blizzard and read A Snowy Day." And it was actually one of the most viewed videos that I had. And I was like, "Well, you know, who says that I have to read all of them in my office?" And I was like, "Okay, well, let's start thinking about where we can go." I had an opportunity to do one at Northwestern Mutual in downtown Milwaukee at the top. And I did a visual of the skyline. And if you've ever heard about it or been up there, it has a complete 360-degree visual of downtown Milwaukee. And when I showed that video, a lot of the landmarks that it showed, the students had never seen them before, never even heard of them. And I'm like, "But this is like literally 2 or 3 miles away from you, and you all don't even know this is right in your backyard." And I was like, "Let's start going to some of those places so that you know all the different places that are right here in your own backyard."
We're talking to Danette Justice, literacy coach for Milwaukee Public Schools, creator of the Just Us and Books reading show on YouTube. Lots of samples available there. She's talking about her efforts to inspire kids to read. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite memory of reading to someone or being read to yourself? Have you watched Danette's series along the way? Do you work in schools? How have you found ways, maybe especially during the pandemic, to get kids engaged in reading? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Danette, one of your inspirations, I understand, an inspiration for a lot of people, LeVar Burton and Reading Rainbow. Could you talk a little bit about your appreciation for him?
Reading Rainbow was one of my favorite shows as a kid. You watched Sesame Street, and then you watched Reading Rainbow. And I just love it. It was like a field trip. Every episode, we got to hear a book, but then we also got to see that book connect to a field trip place and location. And I love the way that happened. And I guess I'm trying to pattern that after my idol, LeVar Burton.
As a literacy coach, what is it about being read to that can help spark an interest in books? I think it's definitely true, but why do you see that working?
I think read alouds can take you anywhere. I think that connection that it has with the person that is reading, be it if you're doing it at home with your family or you're doing it in school with your classroom, everyone gather around, let's get comfortable and let's hear a good book. Let's just enjoy what this book has to offer and the fun, the illustrations, the vocabulary, and just really good content of a book. And you know, it helps you kind of fall in love with reading.
What age range are you thinking about when you pick, you know, when you select your books and your locations for the videos?
I will be very honest. Sadly, when we think of children's books and picture books, we think of elementary. But these children's books are so advanced. The content in there, the storyline, the beginning, middle, and end. I teach a class at UWM during the summer, and how I start my class every day is to read a picture book. And I remember one time I left the book at home, and so I didn't have anything to read. And they were like, where's our story? So even in high school, a good picture book can be very valuable. So really any grade level could find some benefit from the read alouds.
We're talking to Danette Justice, literacy coach at Milwaukee Public Schools, creator of the Just Us and Books reading video series. We're talking to her about that show and some suggestions for getting kids to read, maybe some summertime reading picks as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a classic, a children's book or picture book that you love from when you were a kid? As a parent, as a teacher, maybe all of the above? Call it at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to get kids in your life inspired to want to read? Or was there something that worked for you when you were a child? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about kids and reading. Danette Justice of the Just Us and Books YouTube reading show stays with us, a show she created accidentally at first in some ways to help encourage kids to keep reading, especially during the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite book for kids, maybe for kids of all ages, a favorite memory of reading to or being read to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hi.
Hi. I have memories of being read to by my father when I was a little boy. And the book that we got read to is now on, I think, on the banned list. It's called Dr. Doolittle.
Dr. Doolittle, you said? Okay.
Yes. But here's the thing. The thing is that when you're reading to children, you can pick a book that's beyond their grade level. You can pick a book that has words in it that they don't know because it's a vocabulary builder. and you can read books that are advanced for them as far as writing, because they learn new writing styles and it stretches their imaginations.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Danette, that idea of, since you're doing the reading to them, you can kind of push the vocabulary a little more than they might be able to read themselves, whatever level they're at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why read-alouds are important. It helps to build your vocabulary for sure.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Danette, you've done a bunch of these readings now. How do you decide what you're going to read next, whether it's on the video or to your students in college this summer?
Well, I have thankfully been given a lot of books, and I'm amazed at the amount of books that are out there, the ideas. And now it's more of, okay, this would be a really cool location to read from. How can I, or what kind of book can I connect to this location? And trust me, there's a book out there to do that. So that's kind of where I'm going this summer, location, and then think of a book to connect.
Do you have ideas for parents who are thinking, you know, I've got a kid who's, you know, not a big reader. I want to find something they connect with. Where are there specific books you'd point them toward, or maybe resources to try to unlock the key there?
Reading is everywhere. That's one thing I would start with. So if it's reading the recipe that you're cooking for dinner, if it's I'm driving around and I'm reading street signs and billboards and things of that nature, I'm sure kids love the phone. You've got to read in order to send that text message or know what you're looking up. And if you're playing video games, I'm certain that you're reading something. So start with the things that they have to do, that they love to do, because I'm certain that reading is involved. And then also model good reading for them. It's important that that children see the people around them and the people that they love enjoying good reading too. And then that love will be passed down to the children as well.
Yeah, the word on me growing up is I learned a lot of my letters and numbers from comic strip book collections and baseball cards. It doesn't have to be a classic work literature, right?
Absolutely. Reading is reading. A good comic book, the newspaper, a manual to a video game, reading the instructions, all of that is reading and all of that is important. So, yes, definitely.
Go back to our callers now. Mona is with us in Madison. Mona, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm a retired remedial reading teacher, and I'm so happy for this program. It's terrific information for parents and teachers. I discovered when my grandson was born 6 years ago that young parents today are not even familiar with some of the classics, and I'm thinking in particular of three: Millions of Cats, The Little House, which I used to cry over, and The Little Engine That Could. And I bought all three of those for my grandson because, I mean, everyone buys them, you know, Brown Bear, and, you know, all those other things. But no one thinks of these classics when they're buying new parents' books. And they still hold up really, really well, I think, with children. So,
fantastic, Mona. Grandma to the rescue there. Grandma reading teacher, no less. And, Danette, that idea of whether you're the parent or grandparent or whoever, just getting some books in front of the kids can be a great gift.
Absolutely. I just recently had a granddaughter born and they were talking about the different things to buy and said, well, she's going to get books from me. So that's definitely a great gift.
Mona, thanks a lot for that call. Danette, I know one of your goals, not just with the videos, but in your work, is closing disparities, gaps in reading, racial disparities in others. Can you talk a little more about how you're hoping to help tackle that?
I think a lot of our children just don't see people reading. And if they can see people that look like them reading, if they can see books perhaps that have characters and content that they can relate to, it might help bridge that gap and allow them to, you know, that sounds like an interesting book. And hopefully by me adding these locations of places, you know, we just won, Milwaukee Bucks just won a championship. So by adding things that they might be able to relate to and putting a book there, maybe jarring, striking their interest in reading.
Now, you worked your way into this YouTube series because of the pandemic. Are you going to stop doing it now the kids are back in the schools?
I am not. I am not. In fact, my plan is to spend the summer continuing with a weekly read aloud, but along with the read aloud, I plan on having an activity and then a location. So they'll have a read aloud, an activity that the student can do by themselves or with their family or with summer school, and hopefully a field trip idea that they could do right here in Milwaukee.
Now, we've talked about the books and the locations. Did I see a picture of you dressed up as a pizza for one of these?
You did. You did. I was at Palermo's and they were so kind enough to invite me in to do a read aloud. And not only did we get to read, but we also, I had my nephew, Macy O'Bracy, who is my production person, do the pizza making. So they got to see how pizzas were made, and it was made in this giant oven that was brought from Italy. So just a wonderful experience. The students here at Seaford love the pizza and they love the donut. Food, of course.
And in just our last few moments, if you don't mind spoiling it, what are some of your next few locations?
Well, I definitely plan on going to the zoo, the Milwaukee County Zoo, the domes. I just got information about a water treatment center, which I never thought of. Wow, I never even thought to read that, but I actually found a book that would go perfectly with that, but exposing children to some careers that maybe they never thought of. So I'm looking forward to that one. Summerfest, I'll be doing a read aloud at Summerfest. Actually, that one should be coming up very soon. And hopefully some of the parks and hiking, the Hank Aaron Trail, exposing them to some of that. And then, of course, I got to get to State Fair because that's one of my favorite things to do in the summertime. So definitely have to get there.
Danette, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Danette Justice. She's a literacy coach with Milwaukee Public Schools, creator of the Just Us and Books reading show on YouTube. She was with us today to talk about her show and to share some reading advice for parents and kids. In early May, a leaked draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court suggested that it may be poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. If that happens, a Wisconsin law from 1849 could take force again and ban nearly all abortions in the state immediately. As Bridget Bowden reports, the state's abortion providers are already planning for a potential post-Roe reality.
On a recent Friday morning, Dr. Allie Linton was meeting with a patient to begin a medication abortion.
Okay. Whenever you feel ready, you can take that first tablet.
Linton works at Planned Parenthood's Water Street Health Center in Milwaukee, providing both medication and surgical abortions. Since last December's oral arguments at the Supreme Court, Linton and other staff at the center have been planning for the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the end of legal abortion in Wisconsin. Even still, the leaked draft opinion took her by surprise.
I was sitting on my couch and I got a text from actually another abortion provider here in Milwaukee saying, is this real?
Now, she says the planning has kicked into hyperdrive. They don't know exactly when the decision will come down, but they expect it to be in the next few weeks. While they wait, they're making sure to let patients know that some of the options they have now may not always be on the table.
We are telling patients we don't know how much longer we can provide abortions here, and that includes treatment for a failed procedure as long as the pregnancy is ongoing.
The clinic's recovery room is calm with dim lighting and soft music. Arielle Moulton is in one of the room's curtained areas waiting to begin a surgical abortion procedure.
I'm about 12 weeks and 7 days now.
Moulton is in recovery from substance abuse, and her pregnancy was not planned. She says she was already considering having an abortion before the leaked draft opinion, but hearing the news made her even more sure.
I mean, I knew what I wanted to do, but I mean, even after knowing that, I knew I had to get done because it's almost like I couldn't even consider not doing it because if I waited too long, then it's too late, you know?
She says she's alarmed at the potential of losing legal access to abortion in the state and wonders what someone in her situation would do if Roe v. Wade was overturned.
Nobody wants to get an abortion or do this, you know what I mean? But it's like sometimes that's a better option than having like another life, you know, in this world that just can't be provided for normally. Like, I wouldn't want somebody else to go through that.
But even within the recovery room, feelings about the potential end of Roe v. Wade are mixed. Another patient who didn't want to use her name says even though she's choosing to end her pregnancy, she doesn't support abortion.
If they banned abortions, I wouldn't really be upset. It was just like, it happened. Like, you know, people just need to be more careful.
If Roe v. Wade does fall, Wisconsin abortion seekers could still travel to states like Illinois, where the procedures would still be legal. Planned Parenthood has already chosen staff members whose main jobs would become helping people get across the border. And many Water Street Clinic staffers are planning to get licensed to practice in Illinois, including nurse Susan Hedges.
For me, I'm in the phase of my life where my children are grown, so I could go down there for an entire week and come back. Potentially, I could rent an apartment down there, or I could move there.
Planned Parenthood has made it clear that no staff members would lose their jobs if abortion was outlawed in the state. But operations at the Water Street Clinic would look very different. Dr. Linton says the changes would be immediate.
The day of the ruling, the minute that ruling comes out, we have to suspend all abortion procedures.
Clinic staff is also trying to schedule procedures around the days when they think it's most likely a ruling will be released.
We don't want a patient coming thinking that they're going to get health care that day, and then we have to tell them no, based on a ruling that just came down, we have to turn you away.
For now, clinic staff is in a state of limbo, trying to see as many patients as they can before possibly having to stop abortion services. Still, they say no amount of planning can completely prepare them for the changes that may be on the horizon. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we learn more about gun control proposals in Congress, a couple of bills in the House, and negotiations in the Senate with still uncertain outcomes. An expert on gun laws joins the show, and you can too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you've probably heard of the Boston Celtics or Golden State Warriors playing the NBA Finals this week. But how about the Oshkosh All-Stars? We'll talk with a basketball historian about the origins of the pro game here in the Midwest. Now, new gun legislation is working its way through Congress with some optimism from Democrats and Republicans that they might be able to find common ground. The bills come as President Biden called for a series of new regulations in a primetime speech last week.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21, strengthen background checks, enact safe storage law and red flag laws, repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability, address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence.
The bill's up for debate in the House, and the negotiations in the Senate don't include all of Biden's proposals, but could mark a significant step in federal firearm regulations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want Congress to take up any or all of those measures President Biden was calling for? What kind of regulations, if any, would you support? If you're opposed to new gun laws, how would you like Congress to respond to a recent mass shootings and other episodes of gun violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jacob Charles is Executive Director of the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University. Jake, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we heard from the president there. Democrats in the House are advancing some legislation, but the big funnel is the U.S. Senate. What are you watching for as some Republican and Democratic senators seem to be conversing with the idea that they might pass something?
Right. And so this is something that we saw, especially in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012, where it looked like there was a lot of bipartisan activity and a lot of support, especially for a background check bill that would have expanded the federal requirement for background checks to a lot of different private sales. Obviously, in 2012, that bipartisan coalition fell apart and there was not ultimately legislation passed. This time, it's hard to say at this point for me as a political insider, but as a legal scholar looking in from the outside, whether it's more like 2012 and those initial stages where it looks like there's going to be some gun laws enacted, or if it's different and the Senate can actually agree on something and pass legislation. There are also this time around some new proposals in the mix that weren't discussed or weren't as discussed as seriously in 2012. One of those being red flag laws that now 19 states in the District of Columbia have these laws, and Congress is considering legislation to incentivize more states to take it up.
Let's tackle that point now, the idea of not a federal red flag law, but a federal effort to encourage states to do that. And people are pointing toward Florida, a Republican-controlled mm-hmm. state for quite a while now after the Parkland shooting, putting this red flag law in place. When we say red flag laws, what do we mean? What does that look like in most implementations?
Right. So what red flag laws are they are a civil restraining order that is modeled off of domestic violence restraining orders. And so these are non-criminal proceedings. They are laws that allow law enforcement, sometimes family or household members, some laws allow other groups of people to go into court and tell a judge this person is exhibiting signs and behaviors in conduct that is showing them to be an imminent risk of harm to themselves or others. If the judge is then satisfied that the standard is met, that this person is an imminent risk of harm to themselves or others, the judge can issue an order that temporarily deprives the person from possessing firearms for a finite period of time. There is an initial emergency order that can be issued in most laws that lasts usually 2 weeks or less. And then there's a longer order that can be issued after a full hearing that sometimes lasts up to about a year. But these are temporary orders and they're designed for these periods of crisis where somebody's going to be a threat to themselves or others.
The argument against red flag laws when it comes up is that it doesn't allow sufficient due process for the person who's having guns removed from their premises. From a legal standpoint, what do you think of that argument?
Right. So from a legal standpoint, I think first it's surprising to some to think that the kind of go-to counter argument wouldn't be the Second Amendment, but it's this due process concern. And one reason for that is that courts have recognized that legislatures have the power to take away the weapons from someone who's considered dangerous under the Second Amendment. And so the due process concerns are focused, as the name suggests, on the process, not on the actual substance of the law, not on the fact that it's removing firearms, but on what process you get before those arms can be removed. And so from a constitutional perspective, there are many areas of law where the Supreme Court has said emergency action is necessary to protect the public health and safety, and it's okay for those hearings to be held on a temporary emergency basis and then later have a full hearing at which the person can contest that evidence. So it happens in if there are, you know, credible allegations of child abuse, a child can be removed from the custody of their parents even before the parent has a full opportunity to go to a hearing and contest the evidence against them. And these kind of situations are specifically the kinds where imminent action is necessary to reduce the risk of catastrophic harm. So the court has said on many occasions that this kind of situation is perfectly consistent with due process. And so from a constitutional perspective, just the fact that there are these emergency orders possible is not a grounds to think that they violate the due process clause. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't concerns that states should be really cognizant of when they're thinking about these laws. They should be thinking about what time period these laws are going to be in effect for, what standard of proof the person should have to prove before the guns can be removed, what group of people can go into court and ask for petition, whether there are statutory penalties for somebody who uses this process maliciously or abuses it, although we haven't seen that in the states that haven't acted in these laws. So there are certainly issues for states and the federal government to be concerned about, but it's just inaccurate under existing constitutional law to say that the structure of these red flag laws is violating due process.
Jake Charles is with us from the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University, looking at ideas on the table in the Congress, especially in the Senate, when it comes to gun reforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there things you'd like to see pass? Are you things you're worried about passing? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion and get your reaction. I believe that our rights in the Constitution require us to take some responsibility. So every time I see people talk about, I have a right to do this, I have a right to do that, we also have a responsibility as citizens to be, intelligent in exercising our rights. So my opinion is, I believe we have a right to bear arms, but we have a responsibility to learn how to operate that weapon safely. And I actually support the laws where you are 21 years old before you can own something like that. In fact, I think 21 should be a federal law for everything, voting, driving, everything, because then we know that's the age of adulthood. But I'm not going to change everything. It's just my opinion that we need maturity when it comes to exercising our rights. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Jake, Jeff points toward another idea being bounced around and getting some approval for, including from Senator Manchin in West Virginia, a Democrat who's sometimes skeptical about changes in gun laws, changing the age for certain categories of firearms, the minimum age from 18 to 21. I've seen people say semi-automatic weapons or semi-automatic rifles. I think there's a couple different ideas bouncing around there. Again, people saying, well, wait a minute, why can you take away rights for that 3 years of somebody's life? What are your thoughts on the legality of that kind of change, the minimum age for ownership of certain kind of guns?
Right. And so one of the things that's interesting about it is you noted that Florida enacted these red flag laws after the Parkland shooting. It also raised the age for rifle purchases up to 21 as well. So another instance of a red state taking these actions in response to a mass shooting that are now getting picked up on the national level. A federal judge did uphold Florida's law against a Second Amendment challenge. It's now on appeal in the Federal Court of Appeals governing Florida. But a similar California law that bars those who are 18 to 20 years old from purchasing certain semi-automatic firearms and long guns in particular, that law, a federal appeals court in California struck down just a few weeks ago as violating the Second Amendment. I think that law that opinion is not likely to stand. It's probably going to get reversed by the en banc, the full Ninth Circuit. But there's certainly a difference of opinion right now about what the Second Amendment allowed states to do with age restrictions. Under existing federal law, federal licensed dealers, gun dealers, they can't sell handguns to those who are under 21 years of age. And some of the proposals are to raise that age requirement for dealers up to 21 for rifles and shotguns, just like it is for handguns. I've seen those proposals discussed. And I think there's contested history there. There's kind of contested constitutional understandings based on the fact that we have different courts going in different directions. But I think it's certainly one of the things that has been getting a lot of attention, as we saw recent mass shooting perpetrators who were under 21 years old and they were able to go into a licensed gun dealer and purchase their rifles legally.
We're talking about the latest gun legislation being debated and negotiated in Congress. Jake Charles is with us, Executive Director of Duke University's Center for Firearms Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of the changes on the table? Expanding background checks, changing age limits for certain kinds of firearms, encouraging states to have red flag laws, and more. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jake Charles, lecturer at Duke University, executive director of the School Center for Firearms Law, with us today looking at new potential gun legislation in Congress, what impact it could have. Some Republicans in the Senate are saying there might be an opening. Here's Pennsylvania Republican Patrick Toomey from the Senate on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
I think at the end of the day, this is going to come down to whether we can reach a consensus in the United States Senate. There are intensive discussions underway. It includes people who have not been engaged on this issue in the past. I certainly can't guarantee any outcome, but it feels to me like we are closer than we've been since I've been in the Senate.
Let's go back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, I think expanded background checks, as long as it can be done expeditiously and without too long a wait, and maybe a limitation on the size of magazines, although, you know, there's a lot of them out there now, so I don't know how good that would be. But I think they should be tried. But I don't agree with raising your age from 18 to 21. I mean, once you're an adult, you know, there's a constitutional amendment, the Second Amendment. I understand drinking age is different, but there's no constitutional right to drink or some of the other things that they have different limitations on. So I don't agree with that one.
Gotcha, Jimmy. Thanks for the call. Jimmy points us toward a couple of the other things that people are talking about there. The idea of expanded background checks, Jake, people call it a gun show loophole sometimes, places where mm-hmm. you can buy guns without going through the normal background check. How big a window is that? How much would it mean to close it?
Right. So the federal requirement right now only requires background checks to be performed when a gun is sold by a federally licensed dealer. And so not everyone who sells guns has to get a license from the federal government to do so. Only those who are doing it as part of their livelihood with the principal motive of profit are required to get a license. And that's why it's often called the gun show loophole, because people who are kind of more casual sellers of firearms can go to gun shows and sell their firearms and not have to do background checks. But it's a little bit of a misnomer, because if a federally licensed dealer is at a gun show, they have to perform background checks. So it's more of a private sale loophole or exception. And so some states have closed this. Some states require background checks, like California, for private firearms transfers. And as the caller suggested, some of the concerns that folks have is that this would be done quickly. What some of those states have done is said, you just go to a FFL, a federally licensed dealer, and you get the background check done there. And it's worth noting that at dealers, most checks are instantaneous. The background check is called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, and most checks are completed instantly. So it would include a lot more sales than we currently have included in the background check requirement. It's really hard to say what number of sales that is, because just by their nature of being these private sales that are unlicensed, legally unlicensed, there's no kind of record of when a private sale happens. There's no national registration, no national registry of firearms. So there's no way to track which guns have been transferred in which situations. But I think it's fair to think that there would be a substantial number of transactions that would now be included in this requirement. How many of those would actually go through it is, you know, anyone's guess, but there would be a new requirement that would include a lot of sales that have so far been unregulated.
Before I go back to our callers, while we're on the topic of background checks, one idea that's been floated is, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, it's a little complicated, that for an adult making a firearm purchase, the background check in this proposed idea would include their juvenile record, which currently wouldn't be taken into consideration. Do I have that right?
I'm not actually sure about that. I haven't seen that proposal, and I'm actually not sure. I don't know. Yeah, I would think that maybe if there are sealed juvenile records, then maybe they aren't, but I'm actually not sure.
All right, I'll dig more into that one then. Let's go back to your calls now. Pete is with us in Eau Claire. Pete, hi.
Yes, sir. So I guess I'm not really against sensible, gun laws, but I'm not sure how effective they'll be. I am in my mid-60s, and something has changed in society since the 1970s. Gun laws have become more restrictive. I know when I've bought guns in the past, there's been a 3-day waiting period. There's background checks. Prior to the 70s, there still were semi-automatic rifles. Back at the turn of the century, some of the first hunting guns were semi-automatics. An assault rifle is really a cosmetic thing. I don't know how well some of these gun laws will work. I mean, take Chicago, for instance, some of the most restrictive gun laws in the country. You know, 40 people were shot there last week and 10 killed. I would guess that the number of murders committed by law-abiding, sane gun owners annually is probably zero.
Pete, thanks for the call. People point towards Chicago a lot, Jake. As I understand it from some Harvard Health studies, many of the crime guns used in Chicago came from states with laxer gun control laws, many Indiana, some from here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. One of the problems with from Chicago's perspective of trying to regulate guns is that it's really easy to get guns right across the border in Indiana, which has significantly looser gun laws. And so that creates a problem for jurisdictions where, you know, guns can freely flow into the area. The caller is right that there, you know, there is this concern among those who are opposed to gun laws about whether or not those who are intent on doing harm will just break the law anyways. I think there is some reason to doubt that that's always the case, as we saw in the Texas shooting. The perpetrator waited until his 18th birthday, at which point, under federal law, he could legally go into the gun dealer and buy a weapon. I've seen some reporting that he tried to get access to a rifle earlier. If the federal law had not stood in his way, if there was no age requirement, and he could have gone and got a rifle when he was 17, maybe he would have undertaken these acts earlier. If federal law had been changed to require him to be 21, maybe he would have been discouraged enough to not commit these acts at that time. Of course, it's hard to say what would have happened under a hypothetical situation. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have evidence that there are at least some people who are intent on doing harm, even intent on doing harm to others, who are dissuaded because there are legal barriers in the way. And that's to say nothing of the fact that some gun laws are actually designed to help with gun suicide rates. And we know that suicide attempts with a firearm are far more lethal than other methods of attempting suicide. And that many of the people who attempt and do not die by suicide go on to die from other causes and not from suicide. So reducing the areas where guns can enter into situation oftentimes does have the effect of saving lives.
Time for one more caller. Zoe is with us in Stevens Point. Zoe, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Zoe?
I just had an idea that I think because I had to do hunter safety in order to get my hunting license here in Wisconsin. And I just think that that was a good educational experience for me. It taught me how to handle guns and where to point my guns and not to shoot other people with them. So I think if it was mandatory all over the place that everybody had to have like a hunter safety education or just a gun safety education, not to shoot others, something like that, it could like deter people from wanting to harm others with guns. I'm not sure, but.
Zoe, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Zoe. We don't have too much time left. Jake, has the legality of that been tested, saying, okay, if you want a gun, you have to pass some kind of safety class?
Yeah, so it hasn't, to my knowledge. I don't think even most gun rights supporters think that a training requirement itself for a certain kind of permits, at least like, you know, a concealed carry permit or a public carry permit, that a training requirement itself would violate the Second Amendment. And if the Supreme Court does what many of us observers think it might do in the upcoming case that it has right now, which is to strike down New York's concealed carry law, the restrictive version of it, then we might see more states adopting stricter training requirements. One thing that we're seeing happening in a large number of states, though, is going in the opposite direction. So states that are moving to eliminate their permit requirement altogether, which eliminates any background check requirement and eliminates any training requirement that they previously had.
Zoe, thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Jake, how big a deal is this Supreme Court case you just mentioned?
Yeah, it has a potential to be pretty monumental. So the exact law at issue exists in about 6 to 8 other states, depending on how you count. But that accounts for about 25% of the population. But the Supreme Court might also change the way that lower courts are supposed to decide these kind of challenges in Second Amendment cases. And that has the potential to be even more monumental than just this one particular type of law. So we'll be watching to see if the court requires lower courts to look only to history and tradition, or if they allow courts to consider the effectiveness of regulation.
Jake, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jacob Charles is Executive Director of the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University. He's with us today for a look at the prospects for new gun laws in Congress. All eyes on the Senate right now and negotiations between senators of both parties. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it was the Super Bowl of Spelling Bees. Meet a Wisconsin contestant just back from the Big Scripps National Spelling Bee and get an inside look at what it's like to spell in the spotlight. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Do you have a hobby, something you like to do in your spare time, you know, for fun? Well, we want to hear about it. Email us now about your favorite hobby, or maybe one you're just getting back into, or when you want to start. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org, or make plans to call in tomorrow. From 4 to 4:30 tomorrow, we want to hear your hobby story. As you may have heard, my hobbies include board games, love them, and playing music. Pretty sure music's a hobby for me. I haven't really made money on it in the last couple of decades. And does yard work count, or do you have to like it to make it a hobby? I don't know. Let us know your hobby story. You can start the conversation now. Email centraltime@wpr.org. Hobby news you can use. This is Central Time.